Have you ever wanted to work in a flying ICU? Or maybe you're just passionate about saving lives. Right now you can realize your dream by applying to work for one of the best teams in the air medical industry. Air Methods is currently hiring qualified flight nurses, medics, and mechanics to join our air medical team. Check out our new salary and benefits packages. Visit airmethods.com/careers and apply today. That's airmethods.com/careers.
Howdy, y'all. Before we get started with this episode, I want to make a quick announcement. We talked to Drs. Rimley Crowe and Brent Myers about their great paper on ketamine, but we did it at the Gathering of Equals conference, and we borrowed the studio, the portable studio there from Prodigy EMS. And as it turns out, we were interviewing Rimley and Brent there about this topic, and we weren't the only ones who wanted to talk to them. So my good friends, Hillary Gates and Rob Lawrence, have a new podcast called EMS Educators, powered by Prodigy EMS. And they also sat down with Rimley and Brent, and they talked about this same topic about ketamine use, but they talked about it from the perspective of an EMS educator. Do yourself a favor right after you listen to this pod, of course, and go to wherever you get your podcast and look for EMS Educators Podcast. Great new offering from Prodigy EMS, Hillary Gates and Rob Lawrence. Let's get on with the show, y'all.
What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top, located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project Podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
Howdy, y'all. I'm Dr. Jeff Jarvis, and we are back with another episode of the EMS Lighthouse Project. This one is a special episode. It's special because we just had the Gathering of Eagles in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, at the incredible Hard Rock Cafe, wonderful facility. It was a great conference. It was so good to be back in person, meeting with all of my friends and colleagues. It was a great time. Well, while we were there, we had the opportunity to sit down in the great studios that the folks at Prodigy EMS had set up to record some video. Well, they graciously allowed me to sit down, set my equipment up, and use their quiet space to do an interview. And I got to interview Drs. Rimley Crowe and Brent Myers about a paper they did with their colleagues from ESO about ketamine use. So I want to go through that paper really quick right now, and then we're going to cut to that interview. So I'm very excited about it. Let's go over the basics of the paper now. So the paper was by Tony Fernandez. He was the primary author. And unfortunately, Tony was not at Eagles, and therefore I couldn't sit down and talk to him, but he did a great job with this paper. The name of the paper is Out of Hospital Ketamine Indications for Use, Patient Outcomes, and Associated Mortality. His co-authors were Drs. Scott Bourne, Rimley Crowe, it would also be Brent Myers was the senior author, and then Drs. Ken Shepke, Stein Bronski, and Peter Antevi were also on the paper. So let's talk. And this was just recently published in Annals of Emergency Medicine, and I'm so glad it was published in Annals because Annals is our highest impact factor journal. This paper really needed to be out there for reasons that we will talk about in the interview, but to get it out there, I'm really glad that it was done in Annals, that high impact factor that a lot of people read. All right, so let's go over the basics of this paper now. So this was a retrospective chart analysis of the 2019 ESO Data Collaborative, massive data set, And what they wanted to do is go through and identify every time ketamine was given on a 911 call. They excluded ketamine that was used prior to arrival, and they excluded ketamine that was given in a way where you couldn't identify what the dose was. In other words, continuous infusions. They abstracted some data from that. We wanted to find out who was getting ketamine, why it was being given, how often these patients were being monitored, if they were being monitored, what their vital signs were, their pulse ox, their end-tidal CO2. They wanted to see what the characterizations of these patients were. In other words, or the adverse events, I should say. And then they wanted to identify the deaths that had happened with ketamine both in the field and in the hospital among those patients with an HDE outcome, a health data exchange outcome. So these are the people that link up. These are the patients for whom we have linked hospital and EMS data. So then once they looked at those deaths, they had a team of four emergency and EMS physicians. These are people board certified in emergency medicine and in EMS medicine. The people that I think anybody should agree is the specialty. These are the experts in pre-hospital medicine. And they went in and looked at every one of those deaths, and they reviewed the chart, and they did it asking a single question. Can we exclude ketamine as the cause of death in this patient? All right, so that's what they did. What did they find? Well, there were ultimately 15,000 doses of ketamine given to over 1,100 patients because some patients got multiple doses. That's the reason the doses are more than the patients. And that was over 458 different EMS agencies. Of those, we ended up with 99.4% of patients who got ketamine who were transported to the hospital. Another way of saying that is 0.6% of patients who received ketamine in the field for any indication were not transported to the hospital. And I think that is big impact factor number one, big answer to a question. Are we using ketamine to facilitate an arrest so that patients can go to jail with the police department? It does not look like it. There is no evidence that that is happening. Now let's take a look at outcomes on patients. So 18% of the patients actually have outcomes, meaning they went to hospitals that participated in the HDE, and we have linked dispositions on them. And that was 2,030 patients, and of those, 121 patients died in the hospital. We add in the 8 patients who died before getting to the hospital, and the 4 physicians reviewed 129 of those deaths. So of the 8 on-scene deaths, they could exclude 6 of them as being related to ketamine. So only 2 they could not exclude. Of the 121 in-hospital deaths, all but 6 could be excluded as being related to ketamine. So that's a total of 8 deaths, 2 on-scene, 6 in-hospital, that might, using a very generous definition, might have been related to ketamine. So that's about 6% of the deaths. But if you look at it in terms of the patients that we have outcomes on, 8 died out of 2,030. That is less than 0.5% of patients might have died from ketamine. And again, that is a very generous definition. All right, so we've had two things here. Number one, patients are being transported. And number two, they are not dying at a very high rate. That's good. Next up, let's take a look at what we're using ketamine for. 11,000 doses, 49%, the majority, or the largest group, I should say, was given ketamine for trauma and pain. So that was 5,500 or 49%. The second largest group was given for altered mental status or behavioral issues, and that was 34%. Third group was cardiovascular or pulmonary, and that was 13%. And then interestingly, and it's, I say interesting because Dr. Shepke was on this paper, and Dr. Shepke is the one who has really promoted the use or discussed the use of ketamine for refractory seizures. The number four reason for using ketamine in the field was for seizures. That was 2.2. And then there was another 1.9% that was just other. They couldn't categorize it. Not surprisingly, the majority of patients were male across all categories. And then there were some racial discrepancies. The vast majority of people getting ketamine were white, but that would also go along if you just look at the data set. Vast majority of patients in this data set are white. It did look like there might be a slight overrepresentation, 22%, of black patients in the altered mental status behavioral group who got ketamine. And that is in comparison to 16%, 14% in the other groups. The only other indication where blacks made up that percentage was for seizures. Well, one of the other accusations is that ketamine is given in massive doses, wildly huge doses. Well, they looked at that, and overall, the median dose of ketamine was 1.5 milligrams per kilogram. For the altered mental status, it was 3.7 milligrams per kilogram. So basically right in line with what we would expect from IM dosing of behavioral emergencies. They also said, well, let's categorize lots and lots and lots of ketamine, a really big dose of ketamine, as 10 milligrams per kilogram. And in no category was the proportion of patients who got that dose over 1%. So for altered mental status and behavior, it was 0.6%. So we're not giving massive doses of ketamine to all of our patients. Next up, let's take a look at how we monitored these patients. So pulse oximetry, the other accusation here is we're given the ketamine willy-nilly. We're not transported to the hospital. Okay, that's not true. We're giving it to facilitate an arrest. Well, the only way you could say that is if we are arresting them in the hospital. We're giving massive doses. That's not true. The other thing that people say is happening is we are giving the drug and then not monitoring these patients. Well, let's take a look at pulse oximetry. 95% of all patients who got ketamine had pulse oximetry data. So it's not perfect, but we definitely are monitoring these patients. And if you take a look at other across the indications, if you look at the crosstabs, behavioral, 93% of patients had pulse oximetry. Trauma and pain, 96. Cardiovascular, pulmonary, 98. Seizures, 97. It does look like we're doing a pretty good job of monitoring pulse ox data. End-tidal CO2, unfortunately, is not as good. We're not doing as good a job. Overall, 68% of patients who got ketamine had end-tidal CO2 values. So 32% are not being monitored with end-tidal CO2. And that, my friends, is an opportunity for improvement. We really need to look at that and say, let's make sure we're getting our own house in order before we start going outside the house and throwing stones. Let's do a better job of using capnography. Now, using that data, they wanted to know what proportion of patients in each indication category had hypoxia, and they defined hypoxia as less than 88% who were not hypoxic before the ketamine was given. So if they're given, we know that one of the reasons you give ketamine is to facilitate doing the things that you need to do to increase saturations. Well, if you're doing that, so if you're already hypoxic when you give ketamine, those patients were excluded. Overall, 8% of patients who were given ketamine who were not already hypoxic, 8% of them had at least one episode of hypoxia. So, and if you look at behavioral, it was 10%. So what that gives us is another area for improvement. We can raise oxygen saturations in the vast majority of patients just by giving oxygen. So another area for improvement, maybe we should be doing a better job of making sure we're giving oxygen to these patients. Now, let's take a look at entitled CO2. Why do we care about it? Entitled CO2 is a leading indicator of respiratory depression. If you look at hypercapnia as a marker for respiratory depression, they used a definition of an entitled CO2 greater than 45 in patients who weren't already hypercapnic before ketamine administration. And what did they find? Overall, 17% of patients who were not already hypercapnic before ketamine had an episode of hypercapnia. And if you break that down by category, the highest highest indication category was cardiovascular pulmonary. 25% of those folks had hypercapnia. And in the altered mental status behavioral, 23% had hypercapnia. So again, this is an area for improvement. If we are monitoring the entitled CO2, we can recognize respiratory depression earlier and intervene. So let's do a better job of making sure we get entitled CO2 and pulse oximetry on these patients. Now, finally, let's go back and look at that issue about us not transporting patients. So if you look at the altered mental status behavioral group, this is the group we are being accused of using ketamine to facilitate arrest and transport to the jail. 99.8% of patients who got ketamine for behavioral reasons went to the hospital. 99.8. So that's really not happening. We're taking them to the hospital. So I think that's very good information. The last thing I want to do is go over a couple of examples of patients who died in the hospital and then give you an indication of how conservative the physician reviewers were when they determined, made a determination of, we are confident ketamine did not cause this death. These are some of the patients that they could not reach consensus on. So one patient was a patient in their 80s. It was a female with a history of lung cancer and chronic pain who had been taking a lot of opioids. There was a 20 milligram dose, single 20 milligram dose of ketamine given, IM, presumably for pain. Then the patient died. They died 2 days, 23 hours, and 58 minutes after the administration of ketamine with no subsequent doses of ketamine. That patient, I don't think there is any way, died as a result of the ketamine. But they said there is not sufficient evidence for us to exclude this. So that should give you an idea of how conservative they were. All right, so getting to the takeaway, what is the bottom line? This is by far the largest characterization of ketamine use in the field. I think it is very valuable because it lets us see with real data what we're doing. And one of the things that we are not doing is using ketamine to facilitate an arrest and transport to the jail. I think it is very clear that's not happening. The majority or the largest percentage of patients who are getting ketamine are actually getting ketamine for pain. And if you combine that with the other indications, only about 30% are getting it for behavioral emergencies. In other words, for sedation. So the majority are getting it for something other than sedation. It is very, very, very rarely, like less than 1% of the time, given in massive doses. The doses are appropriate to what is described in the literature for indications. Death is extremely rare in these patients. It was 6% overall, including the patients who died as a result of their underlying condition. Less than 0.02% of people who died could not have ketamine excluded as their cause of death. That is a really, really small number using very conservative criteria. 95% of patients are being monitored with pulse oximetry, but it's not foolproof. There are things we need to learn. And I think one of the things that we may have been guilty of is saying ketamine is, there is no way people can get hurt by it. That's just not true. It's not true with any drug. It's certainly not true with ketamine. We now have evidence 8% of these patients have hypoxic episodes, 17% respiratory depression. We need to be on the lookout for that. We need to monitor these patients. And specifically, we need to do a better job with entitled CO2. 33% did not have entitled CO2. We can definitely move the needle there. So we have a lot of people outside of our house telling us what to do with ketamine. The majority are not in medicine at all. But unfortunately, we do have some of our colleagues in medicine who are sniping at us with incomplete data and making value judgments on what we're doing that is just not supported by the data. All right, so that's a quick overview of the paper. I think this is a great paper, very simple. It's a clean paper. It's easy to read. I would really urge that you take a look at it. Great table number one, by the way. And I think it gives us some really good data that we can start having these discussions with or continue having these discussions. All right, next up, we're going to take a short interlude. And after we come back from our break, we're going to talk to Dr. Brimley. That's Dr. Rimley and Brent. So Brent and Rimley. Get it? Brimley? Anyway, come back for the interview. Thanks a lot, guys. In the next part of this video, we have an interview, and our interview kept getting interrupted by bagpipe playing pipers and piperettes. I think I've managed to get most of it cut out, but you are most certainly going to hear some bagpipe music, so I figured I would embrace it, and we'll just listen to some music and see some beautiful images of Scotland. Enjoy. Dr. Meyer? Dr. Crow?
Dr. Jarvis?
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having
great
us.
Great having y'all. So first off, congratulations. Y'all did a really, I think probably the best description of this paper is timely, very helpful. And it's a great paper because it answers some questions that I don't think we had answers to. So why don't we start? And so you can't really tell this because you are not listening to the episode. But I will have done a review of the paper itself before this. So let's just kind of talk about some big picture things. Brent, can you tell us why y'all wanted to do this paper? What was it that the big question that you thought needed to be answered?
Right. So we know that in the media recently, there have been some high profile individual cases. And I'm not going to comment and haven't commented upon the virtues of those individual cases because it's not our role to do that, right? There's local and regional and state oversight to handle that. But what came of that was national bodies weighing in on the overall practice of sedation by EMS in the field, period. There was no other kind of reflection around that. It was just simply EMS is over-sedating. And various societies looked at this as an EMS overreach, or there was even this notion of this was being given by law enforcement, not at the request of law enforcement,
right,
but the statement that somehow officers themselves were administering medications to individuals, which is just nothing could be farther from the truth.
Right.
So our point of this was actually very straightforward, which is in 2019, how was ketamine used? Period, end of statement. We weren't trying to make a commentary, and we honestly went in with the clinical equipoise that you would want before a study. We didn't know what the results were going to be. It may have been that it was given 100% of the time for sedation, and there were a huge number of deaths, and oh my God, we really need to sound the alarm. So right. We literally just walked in saying, we have some national bodies that are reflecting upon 1, 2, 3 cases in the United States. Are those outliers? Or is that really what's happening across the country? And so that's what prompted us to do the analysis.
So you said certain bodies are getting involved in judging our practice. What were those bodies? Who are you talking about here?
Well, so the American Society for Anesthesia was the first group to weigh in. And the concerning part of the weigh-in there was the implication, and in their defense, they didn't say, but the implication was that EMS was providing inordinately high doses very frequently, either, again, by law enforcement administration or by the direction of law enforcement administration. And I think the good news is they came to the table with ASAP and MSP, and we actually used a very early slide deck that eventually became this study to walk them through exactly how the medication was used in the field. And the result of that was actually a position statement that we all can get behind. And I think that's the other really interesting part is nobody is in favor of law enforcement administering sedatives to patients.
Including law enforcement, by the way.
Including law enforcement. So I'm glad they made the statement, but my kind of statement to them all along was, this is great, but this isn't happening now. So we can be opposed to it because it's not happening. And I think that group led to a larger discussion that now, unfortunately, has moved over to the American Medical Association most recently. And that was 2 days ago that the American Medical Association has released a new statement. And the statement is concerning. The statement is concerning in multiple fronts, but the most important one of those is this notion of the dual response model, which they actually put in quotes, not me, in their paper. They say dual response in quotes. And there was a sentiment in there that basically law enforcement does the assessment and EMS does the medication administration, which if that is happening, we're opposed to that too.
Yeah.
And all of us are. But there's an implication that this dual response is A, isolated only to a certain subgroup of patients. And there's no acknowledgement in there of the overwhelming benefit of this dual response model, where law enforcement on a daily basis helps us save lives in so many different ways, from tourniquets to Narcan
CPR.
To CPR to making a scene safe so that we can remove a gunshot victim. And the list goes on, as we all know. And so for the AMA to make a commentary about how law enforcement and EMS work together around a single thread was very disturbing.
So let me give you my perception. My impression is that we have some people who are probably rightly concerned from a social justice standpoint about the police treatment of African Americans. And then they see someone who gets ketamine and dies. They said, okay, we want to attack this. And it looks like EMS is a good way to go about doing that. And then they started conflating multiple issues. So the use of sedation at all, the use of ketamine, skipping over the use of strangulation techniques. And now it's about the term excited delirium. And it seems like it's a bit of a moving target. So if we're going to say this is all about police mistreatment, it's so horrible these cops are out there giving ketamine. And this is the emotional fight. And some schleps from Austin show up to this emotional fight with data. And they're like, okay, well, we can't make that argument. So we'll moving target. And now they're talking about a dual response issue and arguing over the name of a condition. So am I right? How close are we to me being on target here?
I think the overall spirit of that is exactly correct. The one thing that I think we all have difficulty with, and I have the honor of participating on a position statement with ASAP around this exact issue. Excited delirium is a syndrome. And as we know, once you call it a syndrome, it is a constellation of symptoms without a defined etiology. And so as a consequence, the syndrome can be misused, mislabeled, misplaced. And I think what we are paying for now is, in retrospect, there has been this notion that not only do we have to worry about excited delirium that is here present, we have to worry that it might happen in the next 30 seconds or in the next minute or the next 5 minutes. And it is just like the media has taken these anecdotal cases too far.
Yeah.
Some of the education has taken the possibility of agitated delirium to lead us to sedate perhaps early to prevent a syndrome that's hard to define. So as a consequence, I think that term is going to fall out of favor.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that. I'm much more in favor of going to some objective score, the Rich Meditation score, something along those lines to say, when we hit this point, we do these things.
Yeah.
And we try verbal de-escalation all the way through the different treatment modalities, not all that dissimilar to
I've got a blood pressure of 70. Well, let's start with 2 liters of fluid. I still have blood pressure of 70. Well, maybe Levofed that used to not be so good is so good
right.
today, so let's go back to Levofed.
Maybe we're not so much leaving them dead. This
right.
is good.
Maybe this is good. But this a stepwise approach to undifferentiated yeah. agitation seems to make a lot of sense. And I think we tried to hang our hat on a term,
yeah.
and people got wrapped around the axle over a term that itself was pretty ill-defined to begin with.
Okay. And I think it's important to, yes, focus on some of these individual cases. We need to remember there really are people behind these numbers, but
yeah.
we can put on an improvement science lens for this and follow the steps of the model for improvement. So step one is, you know, what is it we're trying to accomplish? We need to figure out that there really is a problem to solve, and that's part of what this study does, right? How common are large doses mm-hmm. of ketamine? How common are adverse events after ketamine? How common are serious adverse events after ketamine, including cardiac arrest? And then when cardiac arrest does happen, is it directly attributed to the medication or to the patient's serious underlying illness, which can be something like excited delirium? And then we also need to think about when we're giving ketamine, is it just because we've given this syndrome a name? No, the goal of giving ketamine is what? To be able to assess and treat and transport the patient appropriately.
Yep.
And so I think refocusing the conversation around following that model for improvement and using the actual data to guide what's happening. But in the absence of data, we're going to make up stories and just go with them. And so I think that's what this paper is starting to lay the framework for.
So I really, really want to talk more about excited delirium and the consequences of this. But thank you for reminding me that my podcast is a research-based podcast and getting me back on track, which is amazing. I'm only like a couple of sips into a scotch and I'm already getting off track. Let's do this. So we talked a little about why you felt the paper was important. Would you give me an idea about what you think the main takeaway points are? What's the tweet from this paper?
You know, and I think there's several tweets, but usually I want to put on my beret for this. I think this paper serves as a really good version of Mythbusters.
Okay.
So any of the myths that you hear or what you think might be anecdotes, you can come into this paper and verify them. One anecdote that we heard constantly was, you're giving large doses of ketamine. Okay, well, we looked at, well, what's a large dose? Okay, and we found out that large doses are really uncommon, particularly because we looked at total dose, not just any one single dose. We considered the whole trajectory of the EMS encounter. Myth number two, EMS is giving ketamine and then turning the patient over to law enforcement to be transported to jail. We found out that less than 1% of patients are released on scene.
And just to clarify that, that doesn't mean they were released on scene to law enforcement.
Nope. Doesn't
yeah.
mean that.
Just wanted to clarify.
That's a good clarification. And that's, again, in the tables, you can follow through the story and say, okay, I have this question. Let's answer it with data rather than, well, I heard that this happens or I read this in a newspaper.
Let me dig a little bit more into the released on scene. So one of the big benefits that this paper has is you looked at the deaths and went in and did an expert review to try to determine whether they were attributable to the ketamine.
One thing to back up before, because mm-hmm. we talked about the released on scene, and I think something that's going to be natural to hone in on is, oh my gosh, they give ketamine for sedation and released on scene. No, actually, ketamine's given for a lot of different indications.
Yeah.
And pain and palliative care may have been some of those releases. So that's, you know, important distinction is that ketamine's not just sedation in this paper.
And that's exactly where I wanted to go. So I want to talk about those 8 deaths, but I'd like to do the same thing because I think y'all did a great job focusing in. Obviously, the deaths are the most important thing, right? That's about as bad as an adverse event can get, assuming it is an adverse event. But when we talk about left on scene, do you happen to remember off the top of your head how many were left on scene?
There was 8 deaths on scene,
right,
and 9 that were released AMA. So to be okay. very clear, these patients, they were not forcibly left on scene.
Right.
These were patients that were either them or, in the case of some of the palliative cases, their guardian said, we don't want to go to the hospital. So there's 8 deaths and 9 refusals for a total of 17
okay.
out of over 11,000
perfect.
That were not transported.
So you looked at those 9 individually, right?
Looked at every single death.
Yeah, the deaths.
No, I'm sorry. The non-deaths, the left on scenes.
We did not look at those.
Okay.
Those were not, for a host of reasons, those were not the easiest to follow up on. But no, we did not.
Do you have an idea about what, so it looks like you categorized each dose of ketamine by the primary impression as a surrogate for indication, which I think is a reasonable surrogate, and then the dose and route. So those nine that didn't die but were left on scene, that were not transported, do you have an idea about why we were giving it and the doses we were giving it in?
That's not something that we dug into specifically for this paper. So as you well know, we had to stick to the sticky note.
Absolutely.
We've got two big objectives for this paper, yep. And that was explicitly focused on just what does the use look like and then what are the adverse events associated potentially.
My guess here, this is not data at all, it's just my guess, is that if you were to look at them, and let me know if you think my guess is off, but I think you would probably find these were low-dose subdissociative ketamine that was given for pain.
Good follow-up paper.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point of the paper.
This is where we generate more hypotheses, right?
Well, so let's talk some methodology, since you're a methodologist. Help me some... So, speaking of community colleges in Ohio.
That is the community college of Ohio.
Excuse me. That's good. I like it. Well, you know, Ritu can't be here, and so he said something nice about me. I think he was drunk and didn't mean to, but he said something nice about me.
So that was for him?
Exactly. So I had to get that in there. Let's talk methodology. When you were looking at the deaths, and you were trying to determine, you had four qualified, I'm going to come back to that because I'm so much of a smart ass, I can't help myself, qualified expert reviewers. Tell me about the methodology that you used to determine this and kind of what was the voting like? How did that work?
Sure. So there was physician overread of every single narrative of every single death where we had, whether it was on scene or hospital. The criteria, this is sort of the qualitative part. So this is where there's not like a hard and fast rule. And what we did was a little bit of iteration. So read through a few of these narratives, started building categories, started figuring out what are the criteria for saying that ketamine cannot be excluded as a potential contributing factor.
Say that again.
Ketamine could not be excluded as a potential contributing factor to the patient's death.
I like that. So you're not saying it was,
no.
Just to be clear, you're saying it could not be excluded.
It could not be excluded.
And I think when we start looking at the eight,
which is why I want to look at those.
One of our esteemed physicians is here and can tell you mm-hmm. more in detail. Perfect handoff.
I want to know who was voting for who. But so, because I looked at those and I'm like, are you doing ketamine?
So, well, it was a very conservative approach, one would say.
It was. And so that's what I wanted to ask you about. So in order for you to say that this was excluded,
right,
which is what your goal was, to say this ketamine was not related to this person's death. Did I read that right? That it had to be a unanimous consent. So four of the four reviewers.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And then, so let's say that you went through, and you did that independently, right?
Yep.
Iteratively, independently.
Right.
So the first was all narratives.
Yep.
And I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but off the narratives, the vast majority of these were solved.
Yep.
Because... And to give you examples mm-hmm. of the ones that where it was easily excluded, I mean, these were gunshot wounds to the head, prolonged extrications with initial blood pressure of 70, right? I mean, very easy to exclude ketamine as a contributor.
Even our anesthesia colleagues would probably
be okay with those.
Okay.
And then if it was unclear after that, then we would go and pull everything that we had in or out of hospital, whatever information that had come back. The problem, of course, is with our data set, it is de-identified.
Mm-hmm.
And so you cannot, nor should we, but it's not even possible for us to then go out and say, well, let's find the autopsy report. Let's find it's whatever is in the de-identified grouping. So I think when we talk about ones, you'll see once we even pulled in all the vitals and all the meds and how long they were on scene and how long after they got to the hospital did they die and all of those things, there was still inability to come to consensus for that group.
So because I like using your data and I would like more agencies to feel comfortable submitting data, let's go over that again. So the only data you had was the data that lives in the EPCR and it was de-identified. So you didn't have their name, their address, and you couldn't take that information, oh, here's a death, let's go out and do additional research because you didn't have the name.
Correct. That's
right. And it's de-identified not just for PHI, it's de-identified for EMS agency as well. So we don't do anything more granular than a census division, which is a group of states. So it's not even possible for us to say, oh, Williamson County responded. We can follow up with Jarvis.
Yep. We don't know any of that.
We have no idea.
Okay, I'm sold. I'll contribute our data.
Thank you.
Well, we're glad to know he is, because we didn't know otherwise, because we don't look.
So, That's right. I can definitely tell. It was like all the nasal intubations in there, and I'm like, I think I might know where those are coming from.
But not the droperidol.
Okay, so I might know where those are coming from. So you looked at, just a little nerdy, talk to me about Kappa. You looked at agreement and you used this Kappa thing. Tell me what Kappa is and then give me an idea about how to interpret a Kappa value.
Sure. So in this case, we used Fleiss's Kappa, and that's because we had more than two reviewers. And so all Kappa's doing is just looking for whether or not there was reliability in the assessments of the four independent reviewers. So if we have a really low Kappa, we'd be concerned because that means that we're coming to different conclusions and we can't be too sure about them. And so that's the only intent of that. It sounds really fancy, but it's a simple way of just seeing whether there was reliable agreement between independent reviewers.
So Kappa is an idea of agreement.
Right.
What are the potential values? What's the range of values for Kappa?
Oh, we're getting tough here.
Absolutely. It's a nerdy podcast.
Yeah.
Zero?
To one. Yeah. So 0.7 is acceptable. 0.8 is good. 0.9 is great.
And then, so one would mean what?
Perfect agreement.
Zero?
No agreement.
Okay.
Random.
Perfect. All right. I think that's about as much as we can squeeze out of the nerdy talk.
Really?
Yeah. I know. It's just like, I got a PhD in... Nerdy talk. Bring it. All right. So you mentioned that this was a conservative methodology. And yeah, I was looking at it, I really thought it was pretty conservative too. Mm-hmm. Just to help refresh your memory, because I couldn't remember that either, let's take a look at the eight deaths, because this is really what we were trying to adjudicate.
Right.
And so to give us an idea, would you mind going over those eight cases? Because I think it's kind of important. And y'all let me know. Just think about this. Your question that you're trying to answer is, given this information, do you think that ketamine was the cause of these people's deaths?
Sure. And so the two out of hospital are actually, for those who are reading the paper, that they're actually in the text of the paper. Mm-hmm. And then there's a table for the six in hospital deaths. And so if we look at the two out of hospital deaths, right, the first of those was a 50-year-old female that the best we could tell from the narrative, neighbors had called after hearing noises. Unclear exactly, but it was not a first-party caller.
Okay.
EMS arrived to find her in her home alone. She had some superficial lacerations to her arm that the best we could tell, again, were self-inflicted, but no way to know that for sure. And then when they tried to move her to the stretcher...
But you said superficial.
Yes. Like, they were just bandaged, no tourniquet, nothing like that to control them. And... when they tried to move her either to the stretcher or as the stretcher started moving, I don't recall exactly, but somewhere in attempting to move her for treatment, extreme agitation became very difficult to handle. And she got 250 milligrams IM of ketamine.
Single dose?
Single dose.
Okay.
And 9 minutes later, she was in asystole. That's all the information we have. Because she was not transported. There's no, and even if there was an autopsy, we wouldn't have it, but there's not one in this case that we're aware of. The only thing that's added to that is in the narrative, there was this statement that bystanders ascribed methamphetamine use. I don't recall that the crew saw any evidence of that, but that neighbors, whoever made this phone call, stated that. Again, no way to independently verify that.
Yep.
So as a consequence, we couldn't come to agreement. I think, had there been drug paraphernalia and obvious methamphetamine use, perhaps there would have been a different vote. I don't know. But based on what we had, there was no way to 100% exclude. And I'll tell you, having sat through all of these iterations, often the debate came down to, was it the last drug the patient received? And was there any other obvious cause of death?
And the amount of time.
And the amount of time between.
Well, in the in-hospital, that was a real big issue for me.
Right.
So the patient you just described is one of the two that you could not exclude.
In the out-of-hospital setting.
In the out-of-hospital setting.
That's correct.
So I'm curious, because that was not the one I was thinking about. I remember reading it and going, Oh, that's problematic. I can see why you would not necessarily be able to exclude that. I'm kind of curious, what was the vote? Was that a unanimous, we cannot exclude, or was there some...
My recollection is that the two out of hospitals were unanimous.
Okay.
I don't know that 100%, but that my recollection is these were not... So basically, we would do the independent spreadsheet voting,
yep,
and then we would come together, and we would review and discuss. Mm-hmm. And they would say, that one, can't... Nobody's going to change.
So there was, even after the initial independent viewing, was that iterations. After both iterations of independent?
Yes, okay, after both iterations.
Okay.
And then basically the reason for the first was, quite frankly, just a work issue.
Yeah.
Is if some the of these were so obvious when you read the narrative, like, we don't need to go pull all this other information because it's going to be very obvious. And then the question after that to the group was, if we pulled a bunch of extra information, are you going to change your mind? Is there, right? And if there was no doubt, like, pull all you want, we're not going to change it.
Right.
For these two, the conversations were really brief because we had no hospital information.
Yeah.
So there really wasn't a whole lot of extra information to pull.
And that, I mean, that's probably pretty problematic. In the absence of any additional information, that's problematic. So before we get to the second case, mm-hmm, I would just like to say, if you happen to hear some bagpipe music, just as an explanation, I think looking at the audio readings, I don't think you're going to be hearing the background bagpipes. But if you are, hey, God bless you, Scotland. So that was number one. What was number two?
Right. Number two was a pretty significant motor vehicle crash. And there were obvious signs of trauma. However, the initial vital signs were normal and the patient was alert upon arrival. The patient received 4 milligrams per kilogram of ketamine during a pretty involved extrication. And in the documentation, there was conflict about whether that was an IV dose or an IM dose.
Okay.
And so we are pretty confident that it was given IM, but because there was conflict, the group said, well, if you gave somebody being extricated an IV push of 4 milligrams per kilogram IV, that's probably not the greatest thing. So we
probably shouldn't be surprised if you get general anesthesia.
Because you're from that. So we could not exclude again, you know, if somebody said, what does my gut say?
Yeah.
My gut says the patient died of traumatic injury.
Right.
But if we're looking at this objectively,
yep,
with a conflict in the route of administration, I don't think there's any way that we could exclude that case.
Yeah. Talk to me about the 6 on-scene deaths that were you adjudicated to not be from ketamine.
Yes, and those are not in the paper. And specific description like these others are.
Yeah.
These were so obvious.
So you mentioned GSW to the head.
There were actually, if my recollection is, there were 2 or 3 that were suicide or gunshot wounds to the head where ketamine was administered for drug facilitated intubation, et cetera. Because remember, in our paper, it is for all uses, and the only exclusion was if there was cardiac arrest prior to EMS arrival or on overread cardiac arrest prior to ketamine administration. So these were patients who were pulse full,
yep,
severely injured. This was a life-saving attempt that it was appropriate.
Yeah.
But the ketamine was not the cause of their death. It was their proximate injury or severe, and I don't remember all of them again, but I know for sure one of them was a very, very significant hypotensive congestive heart failure, respiratory distress, and we all know,
yeah,
those situations don't, they often don't do well.
Right.
And ketamine was utilized, I think, appropriately to try to, you know, provide a positive pressure ventilation and,
yeah,
and an attempt to save a life that was in extremis. So
maybe some little DSI action there.
Yeah, that's like where those come from.
So complete tangent, just since we have some bagpipe music going and it's certainly distracting to us, I figure I'll take this conversation off a little bit. Did you happen to see, because this is another question I have, before you excluded them, I don't know, you may have just excluded them and not seen them. I'm just curious how many existing cardiac arrest had ketamine administration?
Meaning after EMS arrival?
Yeah, so they're dead, we're doing something about it, and we give them ketamine. Because, so we do that in my system. I wish we were doing it more, because it's a pretty good prognostic indicator. Presumably, you're doing it for awareness during
sure. No, those were all excluded. If there was, so one of the NMSA's elements is cardiac arrest arrival, cardiac arrest prior to EMS arrival.
Yeah.
Those were excluded before we even looked at them. And then if at any point during the reading of the narrative it was obvious that CPR was in progress prior to ketamine, those were excluded.
Another paper.
Definitely.
I want to know that one. That's a good one. Let's talk about the in-hospital deaths.
Sure.
So, fascinating table. Tell me about some of these in-hospital deaths. And now y'all were just, and I'm sorry, I was in a bit of a hurry to read this. So, you know, this is the first time I'm going to be like my buddy Rashu.
Read this
just right now.
All right,
now.
Everybody mark the time.
Exactly. All right. I love you, brother. Did y'all try to adjudicate the cause of death in the in-hospital ones also, or just the out-of-hospital?
Yes, no, they were both,
okay,
all
good.
Of them. Right.
So talk to me about some of these were, how many in-hospital deaths were there?
120.
Right.
All right.
And there were 128 total, mm-hmm. Eight out and 120 in.
Clearly not 120 descriptions here.
Nope. Those are the ones where ketamine could not be excluded.
Got it. So this is where I'm at. I want to know the vote and who is voting. Speaking of which,
shall not be revealed. Oh wait, there's initials in the paper.
I think maybe not who is doing it, but let's talk about who your co-authors are. So we have the privilege of having the two of you. Unfortunately, Tony Fernandez, the lead author, is not here. I wish
chief
he were.
Chief nerd on this paper.
Chief nerd.
Chief nerd and chief goat wrangler.
I like it.
Because if you know the rest of the authors, you're like, oh my God, how did he ever write?
Having had to do some consensus stuff with cardiologists and getting him to overread, what a clusterfuck.
Patience of a saint.
Yes. So congratulations to all the authors. But let's talk about, there were the non-physicians who were not doing the review.
Correct.
That was Dr. Fernandez, Dr. Crow, Dr. Bourne.
Yep. Right.
Did I get it?
That's it.
Okay.
You got it.
And then there was you. Tell me the other folks that were there. There's Stein and...
Stein, Bronski, Peter Antevi, and Ken Shepke.
Perfect. Now...
Do we need to identify any of these characters for the audience?
Probably not.
Yeah.
But I'm not convinced that they're qualified to be judging this. What are their qualifications? What is your qualification, sir?
So I think the thing that we did here, and all joking aside, is we made sure that everyone was double boarded in emergency medicine and EMS. And we sought people that had specific areas of expertise to bring to the table. So Stein came from a place that uses ketamine a great amount in the out-of-hospital settings, who had a lot of experience. Ken uses a lot, but also has researched it specifically with seizure and some
for
of the atypical stuff.
Yeah.
So he knows the pharmacology and the thought process behind this extraordinarily well. And then obviously Peter brings that pediatric view of this because we had no age limit on this paper.
Right.
And I think the idea there was let's bring people that have different perspectives mm-hmm. on this particular medication to the table to have a conversation. And we had different perspectives and quite a conversation around it. And, you know, I think everybody realizes that there are things on this table where it is almost impossible that ketamine contributed to the death. But that was not our standard.
Right.
Our standard was there enough information in front of us to be able to 100% exclude ketamine? So while people are probably going to quibble over some of these, what I want to... What I want to take everybody's attention to is there were 120 reviewed.
Yep.
The other 114 are as solid as this table. Mm-hmm. Right? If these are the six,
right.
then you can imagine what the other 114 look like.
Which is the reason I want to quibble, actually. But so since really we're using this paper, whether that was the intent of the authors or not, we, meaning the non-authors, are absolutely going to use this paper. And we're going to use it as evidence to combat this notion mm-hmm. that law enforcement is directing paramedics to give ketamine to transport. So one of the things that was in the bill that I found in the Colorado bill is what we're talking about.
Yes, where Remley testified, by the way.
Yes, and I do want to talk about that. So remind me. I definitely want to talk about that. When we're talking about one part of that bill was about an advisory committee. And they specifically said this overall EMS advisory committee must now have a specific set-aside representative from the psychiatrist and must have a specific set-aside representative from anesthesiology. Now, this is overall EMS. Mm-hmm. It's not the advisory panel for the use of ketamine. Mm-hmm. So they're saying you must have a psychiatrist and must have anesthesiology.
And no more than 5 NAMSP.
Which is what really set my hair on fire. If you're wondering where this went, that's what got it. So they said you can't have more than a certain number of representatives from EMSP. And clearly what they're saying here is we need broad representation from all of the relevant fields of medicine. So, Dr. Myers, tell me, why did you just use EM, EMS, the two specialties that got us in this mix to begin with? Why didn't you get representation from anesthesia and psychiatry? Because clearly they're the specialties that know about this thing.
So, the first
Would you
thing,
like me to tee that up a little better perfect. For you?
So the first thing that happened when the American Society for Anesthesia put forward their statement was we joked that we were going to put forward a statement about how CRNAs should use ketamine in the OR because we had just as much insight into how they do it as anesthesia does in how EMS operates.
I did, when I was in training, I did 8-9 hours in the OR. Yes. I mean, I was there for an entire month.
Right, should be enough. So the beauty is that while we've kind of known this for 40 years, the House of Medicine has recognized EMS as a subspecialty with an understanding of how things operate in the out-of-hospital environment. Now, does that mean that we're not subject to oversight? Of course not.
Right?
Of course we are. We should be subject to oversight by our internal employer. We should be subject to oversight by the community. Writ large, we should be subject to oversight by our medical boards.
As
all of those
every things, other specialty
every
should
other
be.
Specialty should be. The difference is that, and I'm not saying this in a pejorative way, I'm just saying this as a factual thing. If there is an inadvertent use of a medication in the in-hospital environment, the people in the hospital are aware of it.
Yep.
If there's an inadvertent utilization of a medication in the EMS environment, the entire community is aware of it immediately. I'm not saying that level of oversight is wrong. I welcome that level of oversight
right.
for EMS. We should have that level of oversight. However, I do think there is a double standard when one says, well, that case was in the media, therefore we all can weigh in on it. Whereas if there's an adverse event in the hospital, it's not in the media, and
right.
therefore that single line of specialty weighs in on it. So I'm not sure what the right balance is. I don't think, quite frankly, that any of our specialties have 100% oversight of our own action. That's the fox guard in the hen house.
Sure.
But there should be a respect for a unique knowledge base and a deference to that, just like I was joking. I would never purport to write a
right.
position statement on how a CRNA should give ketamine in the OR. I have
right.
no idea how they ought to do that. That's
yep.
what they are taught to do and how anesthesia and they interact.
Yeah.
We're just asking for the same level of deference and respect for the specialty that we have.
It really was particularly galling. And the AMA statement, I'm assuming this came up from the House of Delegates and they voted on it. And
just in the past week. Yes, sir.
It is very, very frustrating to me. You know, it's been the specialty of EMS is really young. EMS itself is my age. Turns out I was born the same year the white paper was written. Emergency medicine is just a little bit younger than me. It takes a while. I get it. But emotionally, I'm like, fuck you. Really?
Yeah.
It's irritating.
And I will say this. That
you are a calmer, wiser man than I am.
Well, so I don't know about all that. But
walk me off the ledge here.
But there is something to be said for the following. 5 years ago, 10 years ago, this would have progressed through AMA in its original draft form. And I was privileged to see the original draft, and I'm not going to comment publicly on the original draft, other than to say it was far worse than what was finally passed.
Changes were made.
We had incredible representation in the House of Delegates. We have emergency physicians on the board of the AMA. So while I think the public comments and press release by the leadership of the AMA are, to say the least, unfortunate, the actual phraseology of the policy itself is dramatically improved because we had people weighing in. And I will never name them all, but Deborah Perina and Doug Kupas represented us extraordinarily well, among a host of others. But there was a large group of rapid emails that were fired, large groups like an MSP that weighed in, ACEP that weighed in, to move this language. And we were able to, not exactly, but very close, have this very strong statement about physician oversight, not from non-EMS physicians, but right. from EMS physicians.
Yeah.
So am I happy with the statement? No. Do I think the press release was completely over the top? Absolutely. But do we end up with a policy that's yeah. better? Yes, we did.
So it's interesting you mentioned Doug, because I was looking at, speaking of position statements, and an MSP, and I believe that was a joint position statement, wasn't it?
What?
With NMSP ASAP, or was there... Actually, I'm sorry, NAMT.
NAMT.
I should know this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because we... That's right. It's been adopted. We're trying to make one change to it. So I thought that, and Doug was the primary author
right.
on that, really, really sound. It was comprehensive. I thought it did a very balanced job of discussing it. It gets us back into the issue of excited delirium, which I want to hold on to for a little bit. Because it makes so little difference, we can get really passionate about it. So... couple other methodology questions. You measured some adverse events. You measured hypoxia and hypercapnia. Mm-hmm. Very good. It's interesting, something like 99, a really big percentage, had SpO2.
Yes.
As in, we are monitoring these people.
How else do you get the pulse rate?
It... Well, well done. I am curious how you did this in Mexico City, but well, okay.
Ouch.
So this is good. Right. So we are, I'm trying to be good here. We're clearly monitoring at least one aspect of sedation. So if we're to treat this all, every administration of ketamine as procedural sedation, which I don't think we should.
No.
Then part of procedural sedation should be entitled CO2.
Absolutely.
I'm a really big believer on this, even though I got beat up in when I presented this in residency. And my faculty said, well, I don't care about CO2. I care about pulse ox. And as long as they're not hypoxic,
mm-hmm.
it was
that's
early days.
Measure.
Yeah, that's hard to say, right.
Yeah, so that's looking in the rear view mirror.
Is that correct? It turns out we have a lot of glass in front of us. We should use that.
Yeah.
I think there were 33... ish, 30, mid-30s, okay. that did not have entitled CO2.
And I think that one is important to look yeah. by primary impression, and you'll see that in the sedation category, that's far less. And then, of course, the categories weren't perfect themselves, right?
Right.
There's a possibility that analgesic doses were given in the sedation category. But, you know, talking about taking the improvement science lens to this, that is an area where I say, hey, there's a driver we can address.
Yes.
And we can, you know, change protocols
yep.
and policies and really watch this versus... We talk about dose being one of those drivers, and we look at those deaths where ketamine was not excluded. There's no pattern in terms of, oh, they all got really high doses.
Yeah.
So that tells me, oh, you're looking at the wrong driver. And ETCO2, on the other hand, is one that, oh, I would yeah. want to do follow-up on. I'd want to see what the values were. I'd want to see how many readings were taken. And you can keep digging, obviously, for more papers.
Am I correct in assuming that when you said we – I forget the exact verbiage, but – is it safe to say that 70-ish, 70, mid-70s percent had entitled CO2 monitoring,
and
30s did
yeah,
not?
Yeah.
For sedation, I think.
But for sedation, that's right. For all okay. comers, it was 60. Here we go. So for all comers, it was 67%. For sedation, it was 70.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
For those in the pulmonary respiratory group, which were the sickest group, they were 91%.
Okay. All right.
And so to your point, there was 60%, one of the lowest in fact, the lowest in the pain group, which is also the group that got the lowest dose.
Right. And so I can Now, personally, my protocol is you give ketamine, you get entitled CO2.
Makes sense.
We're fairly close to you have a pulse, you get entitled CO2.
Right.
But definitely, if you're going to give a drug that has the potential to sedate you and inhibit your respiratory drive, you should do entitled CO2.
If you don't have a pulse, you also get entitled CO2.
This is true. Yes. Good point.
So
from an improvement standpoint here, because I do think there are some getting away from the stuff that is the just clickbait, let's get pissed off about stuff. Mm-hmm. I think there are some important things here. So one is maybe we should be doing a better job of using CO2.
For sure.
And just to be clear, you can't tell whether this is continuous waveform capnography or multiple... I think it probably is, or multiple people inputting discrete data, right? You can't tell that?
Can't tell from this.
So one thing here is we could do a better job doing entitled CO2.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that's a fair criticism of this. Next, I think that there has been a perception, and I am probably as guilty as anybody else of promoting this, that ketamine is an incredibly safe drug.
Right.
Now, I still think it is incredibly safe. But we say incredibly self, but, and we just skip over the but. So what's the but? Talk to me about the but.
But it is a medication that requires appropriate monitoring. We hear of known events related to ketamine, and one of those being that transient apnea. But when we're talking about a patient who has true excited delirium, that patient needs to be sedated in order to facilitate appropriate treatment and transport. So transient apnea is something that I can work with and I can recognize immediately and correct immediately, but only if I have ETCO2.
Right.
That's one of the early indicators. And so that's why that's so important. And Brent, I don't know.
Yeah, the thing I would add is that if you think about entitled CO2 and a first-time reading above 45, that happened in 17% of ketamine administrations.
Yep.
So let me come back to that, not to derail you.
Right.
But the procedural sedation literature that talks about use of CO2 talks about a delta.
Right.
Something you just said there, I didn't pick up in the paper. Talk to me about how you were looking at that 45. Was that a change? How did you evaluate whether it was hypercarbia from the ketamine?
Right. It's not perfect, and here's why. Not everyone had a pre-ketamine entitled CO2 recorded.
Makes me feel good that if you can get a set of vital signs on somebody
before the ketamine.
Exactly.
Maybe you did, right.
Exactly.
In some of these groups.
This is an agitated patient.
Yeah.
Potentially.
So, but.
I like that.
Right.
Which is why I don't let you use ketamine for chemical sedation by the IV route.
Right.
If you can start an IV, ketamine's not the drug.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
So I'm sorry.
And other methodologies that Remley's working on, she only looks at IM dosing for that
emergent
exact
sedation.
Reason, because that's the only way it's emergent sedation.
Right.
So that being said, the way the methodology was here is if you had a recording prior to administration and it was out of bounds, then that was recorded as pre-ketamine. So in other words, if your pulse oximetry was less than 88 at any point prior to ketamine, then that was listed as a prior to.
A pre-existing condition. We won't pay for that.
Right.
Okay.
Same thing for your entitled. If you had an entitled above 45 prior to administration, it was presumed not to be attributable to ketamine. So it was kind of a poor man's delta.
Okay.
Right? The problem, of course, is for pulse oximetry, that's pretty good because 95% of them had recording, so we might have been okay there. This one has some missing data and perhaps before, but regardless, whether it was existing, pre-existing or not, 17% of patients had an entitled greater than 45.
Which requires action no matter what.
And it was probably more considering that there was missing. So,
correct.
Probably.
Yeah.
Correct.
So it seems like when you're looking at this, you did find evidence that there was some harm with ketamine. There is some respiratory depression. It's not very common, but neither is cardiac arrest. And we spent an awful lot of time learning how to respond to that. So it is probably the correction that I'm taking on myself is that I need to make sure that I'm not presenting this as a foolproof drug. It's not.
No, and
there
how
are
you
dangers.
Give it matters. There's other things that go along with this. It's the message we don't want to send is that, oh, this is safe. Go out and do it.
Right.
You have to think and be intentional about how we're doing it and the training and the monitoring that goes along with it.
Very good. You mentioned hypoxia. Why'd y'all pick 88 instead of 90?
Colorado.
Yep. Stein Bronski beat us over the head.
Well, elevation.
Okay. I'm a little further into my scotch now, so now I'm with you. Turns out altitude, there is not as much of the shit up there. Okay.
Yeah, so we wanted, again, these are conservative estimates, and so that really was our intent. And so
right.
We said, all right, below 88.
That, no shit. That is, okay, I'm just going to scratch that off.
You can't edit that out, you know?
No, editing things out, Rimley basically means I have to do editing.
Anything.
Right, yeah. By the way, thank you, Dan, for helping out here. At the risk of allowing y'all to be incredibly biased, to announce these biases, y'all both work for ESO, right?
We do.
So what, now I'm just going to let y'all tee this up. I happen to agree with you, but what is it that you think is unique about this data set that allows you to bring unique information to this question?
I think there's a couple of different things. So one is that all of the data in this data set were collected using the same front end. So it is really important when we're doing research to consider what is it that the EMS clinician saw at the time of documentation. And when we're talking about a data set like the national data set, those front-end elements get translated into back-end code. So you lose a little bit of the nuance between what the EMS professional saw and then what that got coded as. Another thing that's unique to this data set is the linkage between pre-hospital and hospital data. So we had a significant number of linked records where we're able to directly assess what was the hospital disposition. And that was key in this paper where we were explicitly looking at in-hospital deaths. And Brent will tell you, if you only look at the pre-hospital side, you're losing majority of the story.
Right. 6% of the deaths occurred out of the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So 94% of deaths
6% yeah,
would yeah. have been missed without the linkage.
Yeah.
And I think that's the to those that are having angina, shall we say, about the EMS response, I would encourage them to filter their energies toward providing outcomes so that EMS can have the full picture and performance improvement. It's almost as if you're saying to EMS, you have bad outcomes. I'm not going to tell you who had the bad outcome. I'm not going to tell you why it happened, but don't let it happen again.
Right.
Well, that's a pretty tall order. And I think if we think about the history of EMS and how well we've performed up to now, it's kind of miraculous. And so, you know, to your point, yes, we are very much a fan of the way we do outcomes.
Yeah.
But we are not so, focused on our own way to say there's not other ways to get outcomes. But whatever it is insufficient to have them for EMS-identified STEMI, EMS-identified stroke, EMS-identified trauma, and EMS-identified cardiac arrest. I think most places have kind of figured out how to do those manually or however that may be. Mm-hmm. That's about 8% of your transports. So for at least 90% of the time, you have no idea what happened to your patient, particularly when you missed the STEMI or you missed the stroke in that of hospital environment, or you have a medication like this that all of a sudden becomes a question.
Yeah.
You need to be able to answer it honestly. And as we discussed many times writing this paper, this one's going to make somebody upset. We don't know who yet because we don't know the answer.
Right.
We could have just as easily published a paper that said 10% of ketamine administration result in a death that can't be excluded. That would have been an entirely different paper, which we would absolutely publish just the same. So I think that's the important piece about what we're doing here is that we have a sound methodology for input, and the outcomes are all the way to hospital discharge, which is important, so that we can ask and answer these important questions.
Yep. So I think y'all teed that up very well. This was my opportunity to say, for the love of God, contribute outcomes. From an EMS standpoint, I realize I've been beating my hospital doesn't contribute to the HDE. Drives me batshit crazy. All the other hospitals do. They're pointing, they're laughing, they're telling us we're small hospitals. We need to contribute that data. It's really, really meaningful, and it makes a difference. So if you have anything to say about this, contribute your damn data. Get your hospitals to contribute it.
We need T-shirts.
Give me the... Yeah.
On second thought, that might not be one that Chris wants to. Dilly may not want to pay for those shirts.
Yeah, it may not pay for them.
That may not sound good. I'll buy a couple. I like it.
I've got a cricket.
So let me ask this. Any good research begets more research. So what are the next steps here?
Glad you asked. You may have something in
mind. Since my whole job is to tee things up here.
So I think naturally the question after we have this high level ecological look, which I think is really important because again, the perspective that came out of this paper is, oh, actually pre-hospital practice uses ketamine more for pain. And I think that's an important distinction.
Yeah.
But obviously the conversation and the debate is around sedation. And so the next paper that we're working on looks at specifically pre-hospital sedation. But now remember, the media has latched onto ketamine.
Yeah.
Well, we use other medications for sedation. So let's take a fair look and see if there's any difference between the classes of medications used for pre-hospital sedation. And that methodology is really challenging, as you might imagine, because we can bring an indication bias.
Yeah.
Maybe it is the sicker patients that get ketamine.
Sure.
So we're using your favorite propensity matching, and we've looked at this a lot of different ways to make sure that we're getting the same answer each time. We're not picking our favorite way. It's really important to see, okay, even if we change different lenses on this, are we getting the same answers? And so That'll be the next one that we're looking at.
Is that the one you're doing, Lawrence?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I'm going to have you back on.
And Lawrence is chief nerd on that one. So
I like it.
Let's give credit where it's due.
So it's going to be a STATA paper.
You better believe it.
Here, let me go ahead and make the date now. Tacos, beer, Mexico. STATA. And we're going to talk about propensity matching.
Done.
So see, we're going to do this. Another road trip. This is going to be good. All right. I got to go back to excited delirium because I think this is a fight that is not worth having about the term excited delirium. So I went through my protocols and I made two changes after this. So initially I used ketamine for all the things, including seizures. We haven't used it yet. With any luck, we won't. But sure, well, call me and we'll work through something. Definitely pain, you know, all the things. But about sedation, we were doing sort of what had come out of some of the literature, 5 mg/kg IM. I knocked that back to 4. I don't think there's a damn difference between 4 and 5 in the impact.
It has a wide therapeutic window. That's been published.
Yeah. But, I mean, why just wave a red flag and say, hey, come criticize what I do? So I knocked it back. And I got rid of the term excited delirium. We no longer have excited delirium. We have agitated delirium with violence. Mm-hmm. Now, I get that that may not be the term we ultimately end up with. I think Dr. Levy was talking about a term that had way more syllables, which is, I'm sure, what we'll end up with because it's harder to say.
Sure. But we'll abbreviate it into something cool.
That would be good. Damn. Damn would be good. So my concern about this discussion with excited delirium, other than I think it misses the point, is it equates excited delirium is the only appropriate use for ketamine sedation. And it's not. True excited delirium is rare as hell.
Right.
We're just not seeing it. And when my medics seem to think it's there more than it really is, well, what's his temperature? I don't know, like 98. And his heart rate? That's 120. He's just pissed off.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Now, I don't think that's excited delirium. We don't have to worry about the metabolic acidosis and these other things. That doesn't mean he doesn't need sedation.
Oh, and it doesn't mean refractory to de-escalation.
Exactly. And ketamine is a great drug for that, whether it's excited delirium or not. So I feel better having gotten that off of my chest.
Well, yeah, and we are happy that you did so. One of the things that is down our list of publications, and it's great to have more work than we can do, but it is very clear that most patients, and depending on how you look at it, it's 80%, it's 90%, it's something like that, of patients that by their dispatch, by their chief complaint, by their findings, would be behavior with violent tendencies or behavior with violent escalation, are indeed managed with de-escalation techniques.
No, yeah.
And so this notion that we're out there just handing it out like candy, that's also not true.
Yeah.
And so I think, to your point, yes, we overcall it from a true whatever agitated delirium really is. But there are patients that have undifferentiated some type of combativeness or behavioral situation that needs sedation, that's a very different group.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean ketamine is not the right drug.
And that's the classic. This is my issue with psychiatry. They don't see undifferentiated agitation. We do.
Right.
The studies out of Australia, those boys love them some pissed off people. And they do a great job of describing the population. It's in the DORM study, the droperidol studies. Mm-hmm. They talk about, we don't know why they're agitated. It's undifferentiated agitation. That's not what the psychiatrists see. It's certainly not what the anesthesiologists see. If only there were a specialty that actually saw the true undifferentiated patient. If only there were a board certification for physicians who see undifferentiated agitation outside of the hospital. Maybe we should get them to weigh in on this.
Right.
That's crazy talk.
As a past president of the association that represents said physicians. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, the end of the whole thing is, and I think the part that's been the most emotionally difficult for me as an individual has been this default that we are not acting in the patient's best interest. That seems to be how everybody enters, and then we have to prove the other case. I don't know of a single paramedic that went into paramedicine to administer ketamine.
Right.
They went into this field to save the cardiac arrest, to save the drowning victim, to stop, life-threatening hemorrhage, all of the things that make this job rewarding. This is a necessary component, but is not the reason for being. So I just don't, I guess that's the part that's been the hardest for me to actually accept, is that there's some group now apparently larger than I thought that somehow fundamentally believes that we are not, as a default, acting in the patient's best interest.
And I think this is a pivot point for EMS, honestly. Like, I've learned a lot over these past few months about how important advocacy is and how important it is to go to your government. And so, you know, things like masters in public administration become really important for our profession. And we're learning how, you know, you have to use data to make your argument. And as soon as we use data, things shifted dramatically. So I think that these will be those case studies of showing how the profession of EMS is changing.
Yeah. I do like, you know, you've always heard the thing about, well, your problem was you brought a knife to a gunfight. What's, I think, your problem, honestly, exactly. And God bless you for doing it. But thank you for bringing up advocacy. So, Father Myers here.
Does this come in a stronger form?
Exactly. So here's your opportunity, and I'm going to help my brother Ritu out here. You want me to give money to NAMSP for a political action campaign. Let me just give you some time. Make your pledge here. What's your point?
Yeah. So the point here is that there are always on Capitol Hill forces. They get erroneously thrown under the bus, just like EMS has, as, oh, they're there for special interest.
Right.
Of course they are. Our interests are unique as EMS providers. They are special, and I think they're quite special. And so I'm very happy to be representing a special interest group because I think our interest is exactly what it is purported to be. But there are a group of those all the time that are acting both at your state and at your federal level. We have to have the appropriate voice to be able to emphasize. And so I think the best example of that is the Access to Emergency Medicines Act, right? Mm-hmm. This notion that the DEA, doing their due diligence, said, well, these ways to administer, not the Controlled Substances Act. The Controlled Substances Act is our Ten Commandments. There's not a commandment about that. Therefore, you shall not. The fact that we were able to recognize that, and we had partners. I'm not saying that we did not.
Right.
But NAMSP led the fight to get that bill passed, to preserve our ability to give controlled substance. Well, that type of thing happens all the time in the background. Here's one example. There'll be another one next week. And so to have the kind of insight, the vigilance on Capitol Hill, which is what NMSP does, and then to be able to support those who support us, which is what the PAC does, it is a dual-pronged approach to make sure that we are preserving the practice of medicine in our field, just as others protect it for their field. And it's, I hate that it has to be almost adversarial. It's not always, but it can be. And when it is adversarial, you have to be able to immediately act, and you need to have a war chest to do that.
So nothing made it clearer to me that I'm glad that I made my contribution to the PAC. When you were telling me about what the AMA wanted to do and that initial take on this issue and the fact that it got dramatically watered down and improved. And it got dramatically watered down and improved by EMS physicians and emergency physicians. That, I think, is the biggest selling point right there.
That's part of our profession.
Yeah, yep. Mm-hmm. Perfect. Well, guys, at some point, one of these batteries is going to dry up, and my glass is getting, oh, I can't believe I did this. It is a, you know, it's a lighthouse project. We got to talk about what you're drinking. Remley, what is that? It's a beautiful drink. It's still mostly there.
This is a Remley in Wonderland.
A Remley in Wonderland. I like this.
Tequila and cranberry.
Tequila. Remley in Wonderland seems like it would have a taco in it somewhere.
Oh, that's later.
Is that... Oh, that's not
it's
a taco
topping.
At all. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
We'll get there.
So this was to be a Tanqueray and tonic, but apparently here in South Florida, it is a Hendrix and tonic. So Hendrix is perfectly good gin. It's not my necessarily preferred, but it's lovely nonetheless.
Well, I'm drinking a scotch. It's a $800 gin and tonic. Right.
Every time you say the word scotch, the bagpipes start. It's nice.
Yeah. Well, guys, thank you all very much. I think this has been very informative. Great conversation. Thank you for the work you've done on this paper. I think it really helped.
So I'll give big kudos to Tony Fernandez.
Yes, the lead author gets a lot of credit here. And thanks to everyone that participated. Because this was a, we won't tell you how many months project, but
all
hands on deck to get it through. But I think it served its purpose. So thank you for having us.
Yep. Thanks a lot. And guys, thank you all very much.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the FlightBridge Ed podcast family and a Fire Dog production. Visit FlightBridgeEd.com for more information.